Blog Talk Radio.
We are all one planet, all one people of Earth, all one planet, sharing our living, our dying, our birth, and we won't stand by watching her die.
Welcome to Your Turn to Speak with your host, Beth Miller. All points of view must be brought to light if we're to reach the wisest solutions to challenges we face. Guests on Your Turn to Speak have unusual insights to bring to the collective conversation. They have been invited because of the positive impact of their loving presence on Earth. Though their ideas may be hidden by the glare of the mainstream focus, their perspectives are guaranteed to inspire and enrich us all. And now, here's your host, Beth Miller.
Welcome to Your Turn to Speak. I'm your host, Beth Miller. A couple of weeks ago, for the first time, I had the opportunity to visit the home and art studio of Jeff Bowe, my guest this evening. What an amazing experience that was. Jeff told me, just go ahead, look around the living room, down the hallway, into the kitchen, in his work area. And he gave me the luxury of time to really look. The images drew me into other dimensions. As I observed one of his woodland scenes, I could almost smell the leaves and hear the stream. When I looked at one of his celestial scenes, I found myself psychically expanding into a peaceful lightness of being. And his mandalas, incredible. Colors went beyond color. They vibrated with mystical energy. Several of Jeff's paintings reminded me a little of the psychedelic 60s and 70s in their intensity, but they were somehow gentler and more harmonic. At the end of my visit, Jeff gave me directions to a barn in South Onondaga near Syracuse, New York, where he had painted a mural of an enchanted garden. Well, later in that week, my husband and I took a ride over to the barn, and we both thought it was beautiful. In a biographical statement that Jeff prepared, he wrote that since he was a boy, he has had extrasensory abilities, and it really is obvious to me that a keen awareness of obscure and subtle forces is imbued in his awe-inspiring paintings. It was probably to his advantage that he had no formal training in art. The freshness, originality, and uniqueness of his style and the depth and healing power of his work are undeniable. Jeff's art is showcased in hospitals, recovery centers, medical offices, all levels of schools, and in places of worship and retreat. His studio artwork has circulated around the world and has been featured in shows in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. In addition to painting, Jeff teaches and practices color therapy, and he currently offers dozens of color-tuned services from his studio and over the web. I am so pleased to have Jeff Bowe with us this evening. Jeff Bowe, it's your turn to speak.
Good evening, Beth. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Have you been painting this week?
Today, yesterday, the day before. It's like sleeping and eating. I do this in almost habitually.
Well,
it's a thing that over 30 years of practice, one sort of doesn't clock anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff, there is clearly a spiritual dimension to your work, and I wondered if you could talk to us about your spiritual journey and your spiritual gifts.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. although I don't know if I've got any particular standardized prescription or answer to that. Spiritual journey for me, and when you asked me that question in preparation for the program, I found myself surprised. I really had to sit down and rethink myself all over again. I hadn't presented myself to the public in 10 years, and in that interval, I've been doing a lot of busy studio stuff, writing textbooks and stories and so on, and it took me away from the public eye, and I had to stop and sort of put myself together again. What have I done to be a spiritual person? And what I realized was that I've really been practicing in a very practical way, things that we probably take for granted that we shouldn't. I've got two levels, mm-hmm. I think, that I address my development on. In a personal way, the daily realization type way, there's a waking up opportunity. And mm-hmm. I mean that in a very real sense. I wake up in the morning, I go, yahoo, I've got another chance. You know, I can rewrite the slate. I've got a chance to do even better or perhaps more. Or if I screwed up yesterday, I've got a chance to fix that. And mm-hmm. it's in the way of how I think about my daily realizations. There's always a better way of doing something. I've learned to love my mistakes. I mean, that's probably one of my biggest spiritual growths personally. I've learned mm-hmm. that my path, as it does entail a sense of perfection, the ideal of perfection. But I've really come to understand that it's a pursuit throughout my entire mm-hmm. life, and the actual achievement of perfection, the very best that I could hope to achieve, is actually to be in line with that perfection, never to assume that I've actually achieved it, because I sort of think that gets in the way of enjoying the pursuit and actually giving you the option of doing better than you did.
Yes.
Now, if I were to say something about the second part of my spiritual journey, it would have to come under the heading of more worldly realizations. Now, this mm-hmm. is where I'm thinking about how to behave with people I don't know, whereas the first part was people I do know. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about, you know, daily, how to practice tolerance. Another really nice words that have very practical meanings, brotherhood, unity, empathy, compassion, love and caring, consideration. Those things, when I was younger, were more than arm's length away from me. So I really think my spiritual dimensions are growing into the responsibility of being a real person, mm-hmm. something I was probably just to the left of when I was a kid for quite a while.
The responsibility of being a real person. In mm-hmm. other words, you want to be authentic. You want to be the person you're presenting others, that you're presenting to others. Is that... am I getting that straight?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, too, I would add that I like very much to take away as much of the mask, if you will, the presentation that we have to the world that we know darn well is a mask. You know, it's not what we really feel. It's not what we're really thinking. We're trying to fit in. I really don't like that mask. That really is mm-hmm. cumbersome, especially in the work that I'm doing, where pretense does not serve anybody that I'm trying to help.
Right. So there's that gentle balance between trying to live out a life of compassion, tolerance, and openness with some of the issues that come up in normal day-to-day interactions with
the daily nonsense of being selfish and, you know, all the lesser feelings that don't serve anybody but the individual or small collectives. This is the day and age where I really feel like everybody should be turning toward the person next to them and trying to figure out how to do the best they can for that person and not to contract from that, not to pull back away and think only about themselves. It goes to healing. We're better off if people around us know exactly what we're experiencing in terms of our well-being. It goes to mm-hmm. our prosperity. Staying connected, we have a network around us which is looking at us and making sure we're floating instead of sinking. It goes to any kind of communication, you know, close relatives and folks you don't know, it all kind of buoys that up and makes it more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
The language is easier to come by, even if you don't speak the same language. You know, it's easier to look in somebody's eyes and impart a message when you have the basic trust issues already taken care of.
Right. I think it's kind of disarming, and it makes it so much easier when people are just kind of open about maybe their vulnerabilities. It probably takes quite a bit of strength to be open about vulnerability. But, you know, I guess like the antithesis of what we're talking about in my mind, as you were beginning to talk about some of the challenges, was a cocktail party. You know, that I never was able to handle cocktail parties very well, but it was one of those environments where, you know, everyone was kind of trying to really try so hard to impress one another with their achievements and everything, and how nicely they look, and, you know. And sometimes it's just so nice to just be around someone that, you know, dresses plainly, speaks plainly, is true, you know, to themselves. Not trying so hard.
There's a thing that's set up in our culture to sort of steer people in this direction of over-adrenalation, overproduction of the self, over-presentation of the self, always speaking larger of the self than we actually feel. To me, that's a huge effort that requires a terrific energy to carry the mask, and the mask actually speaks to all of those different levels.
Yes.
You get more information when you speak plainly.
What about shadow work, though? Embracing your own shadow?
Well, I'm not one to step away from shadow, and I'm not one to step away from darkness. I respect the darkness. I've heard it said that our finest thoughts in the light actually are nurtured in the darkness before they come out into the light. Now, while that's controversial in my mind, I understand where it's coming from, and I'm not afraid to look at it. And that might be something that could be said for in the general characteristics that I'm working with in myself, is that where I'm finding stuff that I trip over, you know, within me, not to be afraid to look at it, to figure out what it takes to either relieve it, to heal it, to shed some light on it, just get it into a workable condition instead of covering it up and walking away and saying, I'm done with it, I can't deal with it, maybe next lifetime. You know, that doesn't work for me.
Well, what point in your life did you realize that your calling would involve working with colors?
Well, when I was young, my parents and a lot of teachers said, you know, your artistic abilities are wonderful, you're above average, blah, blah, blah. And then JFK came along, our fine president, and told the world that we need to go to the moon and that all our smart kids should be mathematicians and rocket scientists. And nobody promoted artwork, and they steered me in more scholastic directions. And I was never able to go back to any kind of art study. So the resurgence of that notion that color had to come to the surface, it tried variously throughout my life to show up in different attempts, maybe a business effort here, maybe a hobby there, but it never really took hold until I was about 27 or so, and that would be around 1982. And what occurred, a big ball of wax was rolling in my life at that point in time. Things were unraveling, and that was a good thing because it made way for new stuff. And the new stuff had to be, or I should say, was new people and new ideas, new experiences, associating with folks who were dealing with healing energies and looking at their spiritual developments. They were looking at various vibrational healing techniques that had been with us for very, very long periods of time, but through various mechanisms of technology and media have been subverted and really haven't had a proper airing until the last 15, 20 years. And I was actually taking out very old paints that I had around for decades and working again with them. abstract notions to the eye, but to my inner sight, to my inner ability to determine what I was doing. I was working with a very, I don't say the word tactile, but if you think of pushing or pulling on something, I was getting that kind of impression working with the colors. And this was at the same time that I was experiencing all these other people. And when I brought that notion forward to them, everybody just embraced it. And they liked what I was doing for myself in terms of the painting, and I started getting requests to do some of the same sorts of things for other people. Mm-hmm. And that was not a terribly slow transformation. That within a period of a couple of months, I suddenly started to see myself as potentially a person that could do this for the rest of my life.
Yes.
It was kind of hypothetical then, but it was a strong sense, and I went with it. And
you know,
within
Jeff,
a year or so, I'd moved. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, when I was looking at your paintings, many of them, though, do reflect kind of an intimate consciousness about science. You know, the repetition of some of the form and... It seems to me that there must have been some kind of science that went into your creative artistic side.
You know, the fun thing about taking color, it's a universal language. You take the color and you apply it to a surface, and then you say to yourself, how does this color speak to the rest of the colors on the canvas? And sometimes it's in shape, sometimes it's in form. Sometimes it's in a motion that's either on the canvas literally, or it's in some sort of suggested dynamic that the inner eye can see that might seem to cause the image to come right up off the surface, which is not uncommon with my work. People see that all the time. But if you have something in you, say science, which I consider to be a language unto itself and not something... Mm-hmm. In some sort of contained vessel and away from the rest of me. It's simply flowing through me like everything else is. But if there's some sort of dialogue necessary between the colors I'm using that suggests science and something that's suggesting maybe healing or maybe a particular way of seeing something, then what ends up happening is I'm looking for the bridge work or the, if you would, the musical harmonics that go between different thoughts, different feelings. If something is pulling me apart on the inside, I look at that and I say, that needs to respect each other. That needs to work together. What in terms of color can I use, can I work with, that helps that to happen?
Interesting. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about how colors do affect us on an emotional level.
That's a wonderful question, and I seem to come up with a slightly different answer to it every time. I think I like the answer I've been working on the last couple of days. It's encompassing more of my experience than the last time I answered it. But it needs a little bit of a prelude, a little bit of an explanation. My point of view on emotions are that emotions at their source are all equivalent. They're all simply energy. And that when they come to the surface and become expressive as human expressive energies, that's when we start to put labels on them. That's when we start to give them collective notions like happiness and anger and curiosity and amazement. That's when we label them. But underneath those names, they're simply energy. Now, that said... When energy rises in me, or any of us, and it is being identified as a creative need, a need to express one of the emotions or a collection of emotions, as the case may be, the recognition I have is that color, being also energy, introduced at that time, can either add to the rising emotions or subtract. And we're talking about the energy, subtracting energy from energy. Kind of like waves coming in at high tide. You know, the outgoing, the ebb tide subtracts from the incoming tide. It's simply a mathematical relationship. The energy going out pulls the waves that are coming in down a little bit. Same thing with the emotions. Mm-hmm. Colors that that pull energy down lessen the emotional impact. But there's more to it than that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the energy of color, when taken in and exposed to our emotional drives, can smooth it out, for instance. You can go into a meditation and you can look at things that are working or tumbling around in you and perhaps causing distraction, and you can ask yourself, what colors can I envision in this meditation between those things that I see that are problematic that will cause them to be less at odds with each other? At the same time, you might want to ruffle it up some. And you could say, well, I need more energy. I need to get more flight in this thing. And what colors would actually step stuff up? Color
like
is...
For example...
Yes.
For example, in a bedroom, if you wanted to cultivate a loving, nurturing, sexy atmosphere, for instance,
right.
Would color have an impact on that? Would we choose like red for passion or blue for peace, or is
that's,
it all
that's great. That's,
specific?
Yeah, no, that's good.
Is it
that's good.
All specific on the person, or what could we do with colors
couple,
that help us?
If you have a couple that are using a room on a regular basis, they're married, they're an ongoing couple, then what I would be doing would be looking at the color that affects them collectively, that affects them as a group, as a unit. And I would say what smooths out the relationship, what heightens their energies, at the same time, what also contributes to their ability to sleep and to dream smoothly. Those are the questions that come through my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it's just one person, then the energy should be focused on that one person's well-being. And you're looking for the answers to questions such as, well, basically the same questions, but focused on the one individual. What does this person need to remain in balance? What does this person need to sleep peacefully, to not be disturbed by exterior forces, to wake in a better mood than perhaps went to sleep in?
Mm-hmm.
And is it a specific color? Well, it can be a specific color, but that's not a hard, fast rule. And I think it's fair to go back for just a moment to the way I introduced my answer here, and to say that the energies that are flowing through us are subtle energies. They're not, in my mind, they don't rise to the level of psychology. When you say, well, do we need red to have a sexier life in the bedroom? That's, to me, a psychological answer. Okay, and the problem with the psychological answer is that's simply not where I'm working. You have to get underneath the psychology. You have to get into the feelings. And then, as I said, the root feelings on all of the emotions are our basic energy input, and it's looking to find a way out. The color assists the individual by culturing the way the energy comes out, the way the energy is expressed. So...
Mm-hmm.
Does red help? Does green help? Does blue help? You know, it can change with time. It can change with the pressures of their current conditions. It can change with their belief systems. It can change with their current mentality. Acceptance and denial is a huge part of whether or not color works for you. And it may not be that a person cannot accept color at all. It may be that they have simple problems with this color or that color, and at a particular time in their life, they need to get over that, because those are the colors that they need to have come into contact with. Those are the colors they need to actually make nice with, you know, and enter into harmony with.
Mm-hmm. I know in my house it's very tiny, and a friend of mine came over and said, Beth, what you need to do is paint every wall the brightest white you can to make it look bigger.
You know, for some people that works. I'm not sure that's a blanket response that I would give just anybody. In my mind, a person is going through changes, or a person needs to hold certain frames of reference in their mind or in their heart and deal with that over a prolonged period of time, perhaps. That doesn't necessarily speak to white. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. For a lot of folks, realtors forever are telling you, paint the interior of your house white because if you're going to sell it, it's a blank slate when anybody else comes in to look at your house. Yeah. And, you know, I've never bought that. You know, it sounds like psychology again. And I've got nothing against psychology. But my experience is that if a psychologist is not explicitly trained in color therapeutic consciousness, that they don't get it in their studies to achieve their degree. And so they're speaking extemporaneously rather than down inside from the heart and from the gut.
Yeah.
And that just, I mean, it's problematic in that, gosh, they're the right person in the right place. They just need the training to get to where they need to be to say it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and
I'm by no means a psychologist. I don't want to put that out there. I'm not that. I am a color therapist because I intuitively handle, work with, and know. And after almost 30 years of ongoing experience and hitting nearly 100% with my color work in consultations with people, I'm pretty confident about what I do.
Well, I can understand why, seeing your work. But, anyway, just if you're curious, I ended up painting my house mostly kind of a peach color. It kind of is.
That is a favorite, especially on the female side. Do you love it?
Oh, yeah. I like it, but I think I'm ready for a change. We've lived here now since 1989, and I think I'm ready for a little change. But anyway,
did you come to that color conclusion pretty much because your husband gave you the free will to choose, or did you work on it together?
He pretty much chose. He chose the color, actually.
He chose the color, and you accepted it as a good choice.
Yeah, I did.
That's
because
great. That's a very productive way to do it.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, it is.
Well, what we had before was brown walls from paneling, and we just didn't want to, you know, live with so much brown because we wanted to brighten it up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it did turn out to be psychologically uplifting to have a lighter color. And plus, of course, we do have some pictures on the wall, too, that uplifts as well.
Sure. And the color of your tapestries, the furniture, your curtains, all of that sort of thing contributes as well.
Yes. But aside from the emotions, do colors have an effect on us physically?
Yeah, they do. And the way I want to answer this is to take off from the emotional base that we've just sort of worked our way around. You know, physically, color therapy really has a lot to do with discipline. It's discipline when a student comes to me and I'm having them doing exercises in the studio to enhance their awareness or to build up their strength and recognition of working with certain colors. It's also a discipline for any individual who's tuning in and finding within themselves a need for, I'm going to use a really, really obvious example. Let's say the person realizes they need deep green in their diet. Now, we all pretty much start thinking about our vegetables, I'm sure about that. And a lot of people have issues with that because they may or may not find the taste pleasant. And so they have an argument going on inside themselves. The pro is you need green, and the negative portion or the defensive portion is saying, don't like it. You know, it's not my favorite tasting food. And so the discipline becomes an interaction with yourself, where you're promoting a better way of living, something that ultimately makes you feel better, and something where you have to sort of encourage yourself step by step to change what you're accustomed to doing, to what you're accustomed to thinking. So that discipline and the interaction with the color selection, bringing the color of choice out from the inner depths of recognition into the world is it is a real physical effort. I'm not saying it's a hard physical effort. I'm saying the discipline is in the persistence, the continuity of effort, and maybe, for some people, the need to change a belief that it can't be or shouldn't be done because it's never been done, for instance. And, in fact, the change of belief would be allow it to happen. You know, mm-hmm. allow the experiment of your life to verify for you by attempting to change and see what happens. Measure it. Don't just let it live in the background of your head. Bring it forward, bring mm-hmm. it out into the world, and work with it and see if you are better off as a function of actually believing in what your selection is, your dark green selection, and going forward with it.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting. Now that you mention that deep green, when someone learns to kind of cultivate a liking for deep green, maybe on a subliminal level, they then are more receptive to eating the greener vegetables. I'm thinking,
it's a remarkable
too,
thing. The associations, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm launching. I shouldn't. Go ahead.
As you, you know, bring the vegetables in mind, I read somewhere that a lot of people tend to be averse to blue foods because a lot of times when foods are blue, it indicates that they've gone moldy or they're kind of on the way out of their vitality. So it seems that restaurants tend to like to decorate their walls with reds and orange and yellows versus blues.
And reds and orange, yellow food as opposed to blues as well. Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah.
And beneath the point, you point to something very specific. Our notions, our learned attitudes or accepted attitudes are the biggest blockages that I've encountered in people. It's not mm-hmm. that they actually don't have courage to change, but they have to mm-hmm. actually take a look at what it is that's in their way, preventing them from taking a step forward in the right direction. Once they've determined mm-hmm. what the right direction is, and again, that's going back to their own inner guidance or working with somebody who can counsel them to that point and finding mm-hmm. out and then going forward, either stepping over, it's a possibility, because you have to recognize that it's there to do that, or disassembling the problem into bits and pieces and just sort of making it go away, making the thing, break it down into portions and bits and pieces that are so small they're non-threatening and they just dissolve and go away. That's
yeah.
a very real possibility.
Mm-hmm. Baby steps, Bob. Do you know that movie?
Introspection is a powerfully dynamic path in living well and to overcoming yeah. very persistent outward problems that don't necessarily present answers in the outside world. Turning inward, doing the inward path, it exposes you in an environment in which you are more than likely to be received very, very well. After all, it's your path. It's your inward journey.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not really yeah. inside demons that are going to get to you like there are really kind of threatening and overwhelming forces in the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about your choices of images. I know that
okay.
the images play an important role in relation to the overall meaning of your work, and wondered if you could talk a little bit about some of the common images you enjoy painting.
That goes right to the therapeutic connection with the colors. Now, I use painting as a device to communicate a lot of my inside revelations, a lot of my inner knowledge to individuals who are looking at the work or walking through the studio or taking classes. And the color is, ask me the question again, if you would, please. I don't want to lose my train of thought. I took off a little bit too fast on that.
Okay. Well, what I was wondering is, in addition to choosing certain colors, you choose images, some common images.
Yeah, what are the images that I use? Okay. And that's where I wanted to make my point. Thank you.
Okay.
I do stumble around within myself from time to time. you know, when somebody looks at a color and they're meditating on it, say it's a painted panel in front of them, they're absorbing the color. It's coming through their eyes. It's energy meeting the energy on the inside, and things are happening, presumably good things, presumably dynamic things. But there is a limit to how long a person who just an ordinary person, not necessarily somebody under great and considerable discipline, but just an ordinary folks looking at a painting or anything of a particular color, there's a limit. They get tired of looking at it. Their eyes don't want to stay fixed on that color. And it's a variety of reasons for that, and I don't know all of them. I suspect boredom is right up there with the answers, you know, that are part of that. But I discovered, and rather as a matter of course, that when I meditate on colors, that I have a distinct ability to see things arise, shapes, forms, actions, coming right out of specific colors on a panel. I paint, for instance, a blue panel. I can sit down and stare at the blue panel for a while, and I can go into the inner depths of my creative abilities, and I can see the blue change in my mind's eye, and then I can say, you know, there's the part of it that I really like. I break my meditation, I go back to get my brushes and my paints, and I sit down and I start adding those features in particular to the blue. Now, what I realize is, oh, it made the blue much more interesting for me to see stuff going on in the blue, to have something coming up out of the blue. It's a short jump for me to realize that imagery coming up out of the colors that pre-exist on the canvas hold the attention of a viewer much longer because of the subject's interest matter or what it is that it suggests to the viewer. Yes. Now, that's the groundwork to answering your question more specifically is, what images? Well, back in 82, I was working with folks who really wanted images they could meditate on that helped them to get into places that were calm, places that were centered, places that were restful, recuperative, in some cases productive in terms of generating energy. Healing is a big calling, still is, of course. What when you look at a painting allows you to transit from whatever busyness your mind is in to something that is suggestive of any of those things I just listed? So naturally you think of things like the seashore, walking through the forest, lovely colors at sunset, a collection of birds pinwheeling through the sky and making all kinds of cries and noises and singing. And when you take it to that elevation, it's a small skip to thinking about, okay, maybe it's a metaphysical image. Maybe it's angelic. Maybe it's just lightweight spirits that are zipping through the air. And they're not really fully formed. They're not meant to suggest, like, people, or suggest really much of anything except for the fact that they exist and that they embody to some delicate degree a presence that's preferable to the presence of mind that the individual has prior to sitting down and looking at the work. So there's a transportation of the soul. There's an invitation from the painting, and there's a welcoming in the spirit of the individual who's looking at the work. That bridge work taking place is connecting the outside world, the thing you see with your eyes, with the inside world, that place where inwardly your sight is trying to establish whatever the preferred characteristics are, calm, healing, presence of mind, etc.
I remember at one point when I was young, my father had a stroke, and he had to recuperate quite a long period of time in bed. And he had a small book, and on the cover of it was a picture of a beautiful little garden. And it was a garden in the rain. There was a little bird bath there, and there were birds and pictures. And I remember, you know, looking at that with him, and that image was so healing. It was just so reassuring. That years later, one of the rare times I have had a chance to afford to commission someone to paint some or do a work for me, I described to her that image. I would like, you know, that I would like the just like the garden in that little picture, And she was, this particular artist did it in fabrics.
Okay.
But, yeah, I can definitely tell.
I often recommend fabrics to people when I help them associate colors with their living conditions, their homes or whatever. Tapestries are one of my favorite things to suggest for places where just simply painting the surfaces will not do.
Yeah.
But I totally get it.
Yeah.
Did you like the finished work?
Well, it was not exactly... she had trouble getting the rain in it. But I still treasure it, and I have it hanging in my bedroom now.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I have to say, I do like it.
Good.
Yeah.
It reminds you of your dad. Do I understand
yes.
that? Yeah.
Yes.
And that's why
yes.
and that's why it works. Good.
Yes. Well, I noticed that some of your paintings also contain symbols. I noticed one had like a seashell. Others, of course, the circular theme. And I wondered if you ever work with symbols on kind of a metaphysical basis.
All the time. Symbols are interesting to me because after doing an entire painting or maybe a series of paintings, it occurs to me that somewhere in my mind's eye, I'm extrapolating. And by that, I mean that I'm seeing what I've painted in a different register, or I'm seeing it in a different view that doesn't look like what I put on the canvas. And sometimes the thing that I'm looking at on the inner levels is a very much more simplified image. It may be something as simple as a glyph or a symbol. It may be a very uncomplicated image that could be done with a fountain pen, perhaps, in the calligraphic style, or with a brush where the stroke changes its width as the stroke is being completed. Think of in terms of Japanese or Chinese writing styles. That sort of thing is really just a way of presenting yet another aspect of the same image. And sometimes I'll take that image, that glyph or that symbol, and I'll incorporate it into a completed piece, the very same piece that it represents. And other times, I will not. I might save it. I might set it aside on another canvas and generate an entirely new picture based on the simple symbol alone, which physically looks quite different. But it's a great exploration, and I love doing that sort of thing because there's a concentration there, which is sort of like a shorthand in terms of the painterly efforts. I tell people that a good painting from me is 80% bulk work, where I'm just really pushing brushes around to get the stuff on the canvas, and it's 20% finesse at the end to get all the little twists and twirls and openings and closings that make the whole clockwork go forward for the viewer. And it's pretty much true for most of the stuff I do. I mean, from my point of view, it may not be so from somebody watching me work, but the real finesse of a piece is after I've got a certain amount of color in front of me, which may be the engine that I need to drive the artist in me, to drive the color therapeutic artist in me, I need to have a certain amount of color on the canvas in order to rise above it and finesse out the extra insight and points of perspective that you might not ordinarily find in anybody else's work.
Interesting. When I was over at your studio, we spoke a little bit about medicine wheels, and I wonder if you could share with the listeners your experiences with medicine wheels so they could hear your stories with those.
Well, everybody knows medicine wheels are round, mandalas, just another name for, you know, the round healing features that colors are concentric to. And I stayed away from round for the first couple of years that I got back into it because I there was a tendency to think that if I got into a traditional symbology, that I might overstate it and skew it and simply be wrong. And I was disinclined to want to venture into that. I really needed to feel more confidence before I got around to doing things that looked like medicine wheels or mandalas or any of those circular healing events. And there was a point in time where spirit came to me, as it does. It speaks in my ear occasionally. It presents images and stories to me. This was a particular time like that. And it presented itself. Clothed in the attire of the Native Americans from the southwest of this country, where sand is prevalent and red cliffs live in every direction. I was privy to a view of a healing service where individuals were creating a sand mandala. Now, this is the process of collecting colored sands and fashioning a circular image on the ground. They usually, I don't know, looked like it was about 5 feet across from where I was in the imagery, from my perspective, rather. And when they're done with it, the individual who really needs to be in the middle of that concentration is physically moved to be allowed to sit in the middle of the medicine wheel. A ritual was performed. When it was done, I was a little surprised because I did know something about medicine wheels and mandalas, and that is traditionally you don't leave it sitting around for just anybody to come around and see it or encounter it. It's a clash of energies. It disrupts the benefits that are originally intended. So the wheel is dismissed or taken apart. The Tibetans, for instance, always shovel their sand to the middle, put it in a bag, and they take it out to the nearest water and dump it in the water. They say the water is blessed, which is a nice closure for the entire process. Native Americans pretty much do the same thing. They disassemble the magic, or they disassemble the intentional medicinal concentrations that are put into the concentric wheel. They didn't do that. They left it. And after they had taken the person they were working on back into their adobes, their homes, and were long gone, and the light was settling, and I was sort of still engaged with the presentation, as it were, in my mind's eye. I got curious, why was it not taken apart? So I got up, I walked over the sands, and I came up to the edge of it, and I looked down on it, and it flared on me. It just took off like a starburst right into my inner sight, right into my mind's eye, and emblazoned itself. Branded my mind, I suppose, is another way of looking at it. And I suddenly concluded the entire meditation and pulled away from it and thought, oof, that was a brilliant piece of color. Maybe I did something maybe I was supposed to do, maybe I was not supposed to do, but it's done and now I'm away from it. So in the longer run of it, 3 or 4 days later, this image is still in my mind's eye, and it has sort of grown. If you can imagine having double images where you're seeing your normal world around you inside a medicine wheel, you sort of see the medicine wheel around the outside of your image, and you see the rest of your normal life through the middle of it, and it's really getting to that point. And I was a little concerned that was going to be too much of a distraction simply to wait for it to sort of dissolve or go away. And I was wondering, in fact, if it would. So I decided possibly that if I painted the image out, that I literally would be taking the substance of the color within and moving it via the paintbrushes into the outside world and perhaps sort of poking a hole in the balloon, as it were. And sure enough, about a week later, I finished the painting, and the image in my mind's eye dissolved completely, and I had normal sight without the overlay. And I also had a lovely painting, which, because of the sequence of events and the way in which it was presented to me, I call them medicine wheels. No disrespect to the traditionalists who have been doing it for centuries and probably thousands of years. But when it came time to want to go back and become involved with it again, which happened a few months later, the only way I could find the intensity of the color was to go back into the same meditation. And so I found myself in the same place. The same community was in my near vision, and the sands in which the medicine wheel was created sort of rolled away in dunes off into the distance. And I saw footprints going from where the first wheel was, leading off into the dunes. And I became intensely curious about that, because it was just one set of footprints. And, you know, for all the world, I couldn't figure out why one set of footprints would exist in that sandy environment where, you know, a little bit of a breeze and that kind of thing gets wiped out.
Right, right.
So I followed the footprints, and I did this via a meditative concentration where I simply walked in my meditation following the footprints. And it took a while, but when I got, I suppose time really doesn't make any difference in a meditation. To me, it seemed like a day. In real time, it was probably just minutes. But I came to another wheel lying in the ground, created out of sand in full color, and I remembered it as I looked at it. Without getting that intense blast in my head, I thought, oh, okay, footprints, medicine wheel. And that became the name that I attached to a series of paintings that I have consistently gone back to the same teaching, a few dozen now that I've created.
Wow.
And I've had people come to me and say, you know, if you could, because these are rather large pieces. They were, you know, 36 by 36, 40 by 40 inches. People wanted one for themselves, and they were saying, could you do that for me? Could you tune one for me? And that became one of the offshoots to this experience where I started doing what I call reading wheels or life reading wheels for the number of people who came to me and asked me to do this sort of thing. That's where it has risen to at this point in time.
Wow. Jeff, I can't believe it, but we are almost out of time, and there were a couple other things I wanted to ask you.
Go for it.
But is there, I was just wondering, you're a color therapist, and if you could tell us how that works.
Well, everything I've done, in my mind, has been an application of that therapy, at the very least for myself. But since people have been coming to me, which is most of the last 30 years, I've been counseling people on how to use the colors for themselves, how to get into contact with their inner sight, how to focus for a prolonged period of time, how to meditate for periods of time long enough to learn and associate and to harmonize with things that they see on the inside. I have taught classes, collective classes, where the opening question is, has anybody ever seen colors with their eyes closed? And the answers usually range from, I don't know what you're talking about, Jeff, to somebody raising their hand and running a list as long as my arm that indicates they have a clue. If you think about it, closing with your eyes closed, where have you seen colors? Well, any place where you have your inner sight working, which would be your dreams, your daydreams, your precognitions, your insights, your intuitions. Those are all the subtle layers where things are happening. If you think about a family member that you love, the image comes up in your mind's eye. Now, your eyes are not seeing that in the outside world. So the thing you first and foremost have to acknowledge is inner sight is a function not associated with outer sight. Outer sight, seeing outer sight, is not the same thing as inner sight. Now, that said, the strongest consideration in my therapies is to help individuals to bridge the differences between that inner recognition and what their eyes see in the outside world. That bridge does exist. If it doesn't, then I help people to establish it both in belief systems and awareness and real-time activities, and then I promote them, or I help them to promote in their own lives that recognition so that it goes forward from that point. That I consider to be the foremost activity in my therapies.
I see. If someone wanted to enlist your services, how could they get in touch with you?
Well, the phone number and the email through Yahoo right now, I've got a new This is my fourth website coming up. It's in process.
Oh, good.
It's not ready quite yet, but the phone number you've got and the email, do you want me to say them?
Yes, go if you want to, so that the listeners can get in touch
with you if
they want to.
The area code is 315. Yep, the area code is 315-243-7325. And the email is JB, like my initials, rainbow, text, like a book, T-E-X-T, and it's going to be at yahoo.com.
That's great. Well, as we conclude the program, would you like to summarize the most important points that you would like the listeners to take with them this evening?
Yeah, and I think I want to encourage everyone to consider that any internal vision is credible confirmation that you do have inner sight. And I think everybody is born with it. I think everybody is born with it, and it's in play from day one. The reason that it's not promoted, the reason that we don't know about it as we get older and we start hitting our technical years, our involved years, our educational years, the people that don't know can't teach you. So it's not promoted that way.
Mm-hmm.
And things that you are told to look at sort of pull your attention away from the powers of your inner sight. And again, there's a negative inference that goes on, so you don't learn again. So it's those two things in play are destructive towards acknowledging that you have the ability to see, and that the inner ability to see is tremendous empowerment. There is a notion, and this flies in the face of all normal applications of our senses. We're told we have five senses. Physical sight is how we see.
Mm-hmm.
That the imagination, which normally encompasses all of the inner seeing abilities in common lexicon, is the smaller portion of our concentrations. In other words, if you had a pie, the smaller slice of that pie would be your inner imaginatory visions, your imagination at play, your inner sight.
Yeah.
And the rest of the pie is how you see the physical world. And I make issue with that. I think it's the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
I think the small slice is how we see physically, and I think the real powers of sight are invested in the rest of the pie.
Mm.
And I think the correlation between the slice and the rest of the pie are extremely important in developing not only our sense of health and well-being, but our vision of who we are as individuals, as a collective, and where we can go as a world state of people.
Mm. Yes. Well, Jeff, I just absolutely hate to conclude this because there are so many other things I wanted to touch upon, such
Bookmark.
As, you know, but I'm afraid our time is running out very quickly. So I do want to thank you so much for sharing the wealth of information that you've done, and maybe in the future I'd like to have you back and we can talk a little bit more about some of the fascinating work that you do.
I'd be delighted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are
You have been listening to Your Turn to Speak with host Beth Miller. Each week, Beth features guests whose important views are often overlooked in the mainstream dialogue. You can listen to this show again at freespiritbroadcasting.com. And be sure to tune in next Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern for another live, inspiring conversation on Your Turn to Speak.